Now, you'll have seen him on television news occasionally during Senate estimates committees, usually adamantly defending actions of his Department of Home Affairs, of which he's secretary, reporting to Minister Peter Dutton. Mike Pezzullo has been a public servant since 1987, when he joined the Department of Defence. Now he's seen as a modern example of an old tradition of feisty, robust federal public servants, a bit in the Sir Arthur Tang mode, the legendary defence secretary of the 50s and 60s. Mike's obsession is future national security challenges and how we discuss them. He's been a big player, for instance, in the raids on Murdoch journalist Annika Smethurst. This is how he described himself at an ASPI event in Canberra last year, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, describing the way he considers this question. "I do so," he said, "with 32 years of experience in the field of national security, defence and international affairs, a modest basis for claiming that I have seen enough of the past to perhaps have something useful to say about the future." He went on to present a list of seven gathering storms of the 2020s, though at the ANU's Crawford Forum last month, he also waxed eloquent about the incredible Australian strengths on display during the bushfires and COVID. He granted me a rare interview late this week, and I welcomed him to expand on both areas.
Well, hi, Geraldine. How are you?
Good, thank you. And look, before we go into that, the Prime Minister's statements about Hong Kong that he made on Thursday about visas and also about the new laws in Hong Kong, do they accord with your view of the world?
Well, I suppose it's important to say at the outset, because I suspect it's going to come up several times, whether or not such policy announcements accord with my view of the world or anyone else's view of the world who's not democratically accountable and elected, really is neither here or there. We give advice, whether it's me, the Chief of the Defence Force, the head of ASIO, the head of the Office of National Intelligence. We do so collaboratively and collegiately. I must say, whether it's Mr. Morrison in the chair, I can say the same thing about Mr. Turnbull, Mr. Abbott, all the predecessors in that office. And in my case, at the level of Deputy Secretary, I go back to Mr. Howard's day. So it also includes Ms. Gillard and Mr. Rudd. In the National Security Committee, I've never seen anything other than a very conscientious effort on the part of the chair, that is to say the Prime Minister and the key decision makers, to listen very, very carefully to the points of view expressed by officials. Invariably, they chair meetings differently, of course, but I'll speak to their generic chairing approach. They go around the table. We all get a chance to express our views, and then, as should be the case in a parliamentary democracy, it's then really for ministers to collectively come to a view, and obviously the Prime Minister ultimately is accountable for the overall policy of the government. So whether or not it accords with my view, it's important that I don't step outside of the parameters of being a senior public servant, because if I start to commentate on, well, this area of policy I especially agreed with, whereas that area perhaps I didn't agree with, well, I'd be doing my memoir live, as it were, and I don't intend to do a memoir ever about matters that should remain in the cabinet room.
Did its timing surprise you then?
No.
So how would you rate, I mean, given that you said in this gathering storms discussion, you said, "I'm not in the business of forecasting, I'm in the business of risk assessing, and I feel I want, at least the impression I got, this is what I want to encourage Australians to think about." So this falls squarely into that category, does it?
Well, it does, Geraldine, insofar as there's a distinction to be drawn, and I don't want to be too abstract in this response, but you'll appreciate the application that I will make to the point in issue. There's a difference between prediction and risk. You don't have any sense, no one has any sense, at least no earthly being has any sense of exactly what's going to happen in the future. But you can look at trends, you can look at the parameters within which geopolitics or geoeconomic trends are going, you can look at the arc of those trends, and you can also then apply the rubric of your interests and the rubric of your values. And whilst you're not ever going to be able to predict the day, the week, the month in which a particular event will occur, like anything in life, you can assign certain probabilities to certain things eventuating. And I'm making no particular comment here about Hong Kong. I'm just making a more general methodological point. And then were those probabilities to be crystallised as actual events or actual outcomes, then you need to have thought beforehand, how do I either, if I so choose, because my interests require it, mitigate against that even occurring, mitigate its consequences should it occur, develop alliances, partnerships, and networks of influence to perhaps either shape the event or to thwart the event from occurring, or should it occur, to respond to it in particular ways. And whether you're in business, whether you're in any sphere of life, anticipating and managing risks is what is core business. Trying to predict in some kind of linear fashion as history unfolds, well, that requires a time machine. Of course, none of us have got that.
Mm. So you're doing a juggling act, in a sense. And in fact, in your seven gathering storms were the prospect of a great power war. Not that you thought it would happen, but you thought that there was a risk of strategic miscalculation.
And in fact, sorry, Geraldine, to interrupt at that point. In fact, I went out of my way to say that the likelihood of it occurring is actually is in the minority in terms of probabilities, but the probability is sufficient. So you think about insurance, you not only hope and pray that your house won't burn down, but you take an actuarial view that suggests that the chances of it doing so is far less than 1%, and yet you buy house insurance. And so probability and risk is not the same as trying to predict events precisely and, in a sense, trying to predetermine exactly how you're going to respond, because you still then have to be equipped to respond to events as they unfold. If you do it absent a guiding philosophy or a framework of values, interests, principles and parameters, you have absolutely no hope of dealing with events as they come at you.
Now, what you did seem to be more precise about, though, was a cyber attack. Much more needs to be done in this area, you wrote. Our traditional ways of thinking about deterrence and defence simply do not map directly onto the cyber realm. They make the cyber attacks of the past decade seem like the first dogfights in the earliest days of aerial combat. Why? So that's pretty strong and specific, I would have thought.
Yes, indeed. But again, it's about the parameters that are emerging out of the empirical observations we can make of trends. So very, very brief contrast between those two storms. Territorial attack traditionally, and of course there have always been grey areas of, you know, saboteurs coming onto your shore and blowing things up, etc. But typically speaking, you know when you're approaching a war and you try to thwart it as best you can or try to avoid stumbling into it, certainly. But territorial defence has got a hard border called your frontier. And then, of course, you've got military forces that either seek to deter that attack coming or to defeat that attack should it come. And, of course, Australia horrifically had to endure the experience of that in late 1941 and well into 1942 before a sense of cautious relief started to emerge that the threat of imminent invasion had receded. Cyber completely changes that parameter. The platforms by which we connect, by which we gain so much prosperity from online shopping, entertainment, following the news, being able to do collaborative research, all the wonderful things that the internet and connectivity has brought to us, the ability to move masses of data around in instantaneous speed, also carry with that very connectivity carries with it the risk of penetration of your most sensitive data, and indeed right down to the household, the penetration of your Wi-Fi system, such that very sensitive personal information, including horrifically that pursued by child pedophile networks, including images of your children, can actually be lifted by the very same platform of connectivity that also brings us all of those benefits that I described earlier. So the reason why cyber changes our thinking about, or necessitates a change, I should say, in our thinking about deterrence, defence, is that we don't have a wall. We can't just simply put up a barrier. We can't think about territorial defence, thinking that the threat is outside of our border and somehow, God forbid, one day may manifest itself with bombers dropping bombs or long-range missile strikes, as was the fear of Australians during the Cold War in terms of a Soviet nuclear strike, for instance. Cyber has to be thought about completely differently. That is to say, at the very time that you're connecting and getting those benefits, you need to be defending.
Do you want to frighten us, like talking about children being filmed,
coming out of baths and so on?
Is that what you're saying?
Geraldine, it's about being realistic. At the very same time, and you don't need highly sensitive access to information of a classified nature, you can read public reports from agencies such as the National Crime Agency in the UK, the FBI, Australia's very own Criminal Intelligence Commission, obviously in some cases reliant on very highly sensitive sources and collection, but the headlines are there for all to see. And similarly, you can go to the website of the Australian Cybersecurity Centre and the evidence is there to see. Your personal information, including quite intimate information, is, should you not be careful, as the Prime Minister said the other day when he made a quite a dramatic intervention into the public debate, you have the Prime Minister of the country effectively saying to the country, patch your computers, get your shields up, ensure that you've got good cyber hygiene, make sure that beyond just simply changing your password, that if you're a company or a firm or indeed a household, you have the best possible cyber protection, because the exfiltration of your data and the penetration of your networks is happening as we speak. I don't think that's frightening anyone, Geraldine. It's just about being realistic.
Well, I suppose it's a balancing act. I mean, the Saturday paper looked at the Home Affairs and, in fact, that cyber attack. And it said, according to security forces, Australia is currently the subject of a major Chinese cyber hoovering exercise, one designed to map the entire country's corporate, government, academic, political and social structures and networks. Is that right?
Well, as the Prime Minister said, the specific cyber attack, which he drew attention to along with the Defence Minister and the Home Affairs Minister, is being undertaken by a known sophisticated state actor for reasons to do with our statecraft and our need to, as the Prime Minister said, to set a very high threshold for attribution, to have confidence in exactly the mode of attack, who's behind the attack and the way in which they're doing it. The government's taken, as the Prime Minister said at this point, the judgment that it's going to refer to a sophisticated state actor, but we're not going to name that actor. But in terms of the intent,
the question is why?
It is about conducting the sort of espionage and the data exfiltration that could be characterised as mapping how Australia works. Now, who's doing it, why they're doing it, is a separate question, which, as the Prime Minister said, as the two ministers said, it's been undertaken by a sophisticated state actor. You'd have to ask them why they're doing it in the terms in which they're doing it. But the more important point of both that announcement and the forthcoming cyber security strategy that no doubt we'll touch on during the course of this interview, is that Australians cannot be complacent about this, but nor should we be terrified and fearful. I have a device, I have a computer, I operate on the internet, as do you, and it's about taking sensible precautions about how you do so.
I've even heard people who are in the business of forecasting say that the risk is that you become too pessimistic and that you don't actually do the balancing act that is required, say, for the business of the creation of a very good economy in Australia, which, as Dennis Richardson, the former leading diplomat, said to Paul Kelly a few weeks back, a strong economy is foundational to national security, the very thing you're talking about.
Absolutely. Geraldine, that is so true, and I couldn't agree more with my very dear friend and colleague, well, former colleague, I suppose, he's no longer in government service, Dennis Richardson. And think about the word security. Security, deriving from its Latin roots, actually means free from care. It doesn't mean being complacent, but having a level of assurance in your life. And that's why we talk about job security. We talk about financial security. It's a comforting word. We should be comforted in the thought that we've taken all sensible, proportionate and prudent responses without being so anxious and so fearful of stepping outside our front door that we live a hermit-like existence. I fully agree with Dennis, and indeed fully agree with the premise of your question. It's about being prudent and sensible and then living life for the purposes for which we're put upon this earth.
But, for instance, there is clearly a belief coming out of Canberra, and I'll come back to that in a moment. This is this Canberra consensus, and, of course, some people like Alan Beam, the former head of defence, said it's been sort of securitised and militarised, and it's actually not necessarily reflective of a broader feeling, particularly in the business world, that is trying to build a dynamic economy. And, you know, Philip Lowe, our RBA governor, said, I do think there's a lack of economic dynamism in Australia. Now, is there a real sense of engaging with that business community? Do you believe that the business community in Australia is a bit complacent?
No. No, I think the business community, as other sectors such as the university sector, are clear-eyed about the need to gain information, to engage with us. There's not a chief executive, there's not a vice chancellor, there's not the head of a research body that doesn't want to engage. We have great access, and I really appreciate and am privileged to be able to say that the chief executives of major companies, household names, the heads of universities will not only always take a call, but they're insatiably interested in gaining information and knowledge. Now, in some cases, we need to say to them, there are certain things that need to be described in particular ways because we have to protect how we know certain things. But we make a very conscious effort, whether it's in Home Affairs, the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, our colleagues in the Office of National Intelligence, which is doing a lot of outreach out to the business sector. My colleagues over in ASIO, headed by Director General Burgess. We are very consciously, partly in response to government direction, but partly because it's innate, in senior public servants to reach out, to deal with the academic sector, the business community. And what I find, Geraldine, is patriotic Australians who are trying to make, as we are, the best sense they can of an at times puzzling and difficult to comprehend world and trying to apply reason, interests, and often, particularly with the larger businesses, they go out of their way to say, look, I understand this is my firm's interest. I also want to understand what the government's perspective is on the broader national interest. Can you come along to the boardroom? Can you come and engage with my senior executive team? I don't see complacency. What I do see is a sector, and I'd also put the universities in the same category, the major research institutes, that's trying to figure out how to best gear its need for knowledge, its need to hold certain knowledge confidential, and in how it thinks about instilling that knowledge into its business processes and its decisions.
And are there any risks of losing the soft power gains, for instance, through international student relationships, which very much shore up sort of good inter-country behaviour? Are there any risks here that in terms of keeping an eye very much on these external threats, might you not err too much on one side than the other? Do you wrestle with this?
We don't wrestle with it quite in those terms because there's a more immediate imperative, of course, which is how to conduct the movement of people across our border in a COVID-safe environment. That is not an inconsequential or minor consideration. In fact, it's a predominant consideration at the moment. So tourism is certainly a long way down the track. International students, perhaps less so. But for so long as the medical advice, and I must take the opportunity to applaud the work of the Australian Health Protection Principle Committee, made up of the chief medical officer in the state and his state colleagues, in giving us very clear-eyed advice about the quarantine period, whether it's 14 days, whether there's any scope for that to be varied, the efficacy of different testing arrangements. All of that, Geraldine, has to be thrown into the mix before there can be any consideration given to getting back to where we were in January, February. But let's take that as read for the moment. And there are different thoughts and different theories about when a vaccine or an antiviral treatment might become available. But let's just hold that thought for a moment, whether it's next month, in 6 months, in 12 months, in 18 months. Let's just assume that we're getting back to the kind of flow of people that we saw up until late January. Then no, I think to the contrary, Australia's got a great value proposition in terms of its environment, the standards of its educational institutions, the welcoming nature of our society, and getting back to that track I don't think will be particularly difficult in terms of selling that value proposition, to use that term, but it's doing so in a way that's COVID safe and addressing all those other considerations that I just mentioned.
And you're comfortable that the relationship with other big countries like China is in reasonable shape?
Well, that's a much larger and somewhat a different question. I can really just echo the comments made as recently as Thursday by the Prime Minister, the Foreign Minister, and in this case, the Immigration Minister, because of the issue around visas for residents of Hong Kong, that we value our comprehensive partnership with China. It's been mutually beneficial for many decades as Australia works through issue by issue, theme by theme. Australia, as the Prime Minister said, and I've seen this intimately closely, whether it's telecommunications and 5G, whether it's critical minerals and metals, whether it's emerging sensitive technologies, whether it's a question of dealing with the imposition of the national security law in Hong Kong, Australia takes decisions. The government of Australia, on behalf of the people of Australia that's democratically elected it, takes each of those issues in sequence, on their merits and applying our interests and our values.
I want to ask you a question about how much you seek to find out what the Australian people do think. I mean, you have certainly, I think, become known as someone who believes that there are things best kept very secret and not necessarily shared with the entire Australian people in a very much an open style. And a lot of journalists and so on say that there's a sort of a reflexive leaning towards keeping things to yourselves, as evidence in the raids, for instance, on the ABC and on Annika Smethurst. But I don't want to go into those in detail. Hmm. But it's a tone that the view is creeping up in Canberra. This is all so serious, we've got to keep it to ourselves. Now, how do you, again, are you wrestling with this as your view of these big challenges are arriving? Are you becoming more concerned about whether the Australian people as a whole can hear this fully?
No, to the contrary, I think we should be as expansive as we possibly can, noting that the more public you are about, and there's a distinction here between commentary, analysis and pronouncements on policy issues and the reason for policy. So on Thursday, the suite of measures relating to Hong Kong, which I just mentioned, was the subject of a very extended press conference by our ministers that we obviously work with the Prime Minister and our ministers to help them work through in their own minds. They, in the end, decide the tone of what they're going to say and what they're going to say, but we assist them. And the consideration there around certain things that need to be kept, to use the premise of your question, close hold, typically relates to, in some cases, and very rarely, how we came to know something. So what sources, what methods, what intelligence capabilities might have gleaned points of information. But I can absolutely assure you, Geraldine, going back to my first appointment as a Deputy Secretary in the service of the Howard government, I know, and all Prime Ministers since, when they're talking about certain things, I know in some cases it reflects very highly classified information and briefings, which they, exercising their own good judgment based on advice, can redact, to use that verb, down to a level where we can talk in general terms about trends. The threat of foreign interference, for instance, the espionage threat. I know for a fact that when ministers and occasionally my statutory agency head colleagues or myself or other departmental secretaries speak of those matters, I know in my mind, even as I'm speaking to you now, there is information that I know to be, to use our parlance in our craft, top secret and code word, which is a particular level of sensitivity and protection. But I can say to you quite directly, openly, to all the listeners on this broadcast and to anyone who might read this transcript, that there is, for instance, very pervasive espionage going on in this country and attempts at foreign interference and manipulation. Both Director General Lewis and Director General Burgess have spoken in some detail about that. And I know in each and every one of those cases, because they're good enough to brief me on those cases, that the specifics have attached to the information protection around those specific cases, the level of classification known as top secret, and then there's code word protection beyond that. What that speaks to is not necessarily about the fact of the espionage or the fact of the foreign interference. In fact, we should be very public about that in a sensible and calibrated fashion. It's really about deciding what needs to be kept protected from the point of view of our sensitive capabilities, be they weapon systems or intelligence collection systems, versus the import of the issue itself and the public interest in discussing the policy and the operational questions that really should be laid before the Australian public in a very expansive fashion, consistent only with prudence and not being reckless about it.
You can't trust journalists more than you do already?
Well, that's an interesting question. The Parliament has passed laws, both in the intelligence space as well as in public service generally, that requires a whistleblower who is concerned about illegality and impropriety to take those matters first and foremost and only as a last recourse. So, you know, we hear a lot about laws, we hear a lot about legal protections, but the Parliament of this land has actually introduced whistleblower protections that would require, and I won't speak to a couple of the cases that you refer to. The ABC file, so-called, is not a matter that my department's involved in, because that's to do with the Australian Defence Force. And the matter involving Ms. Smethurst that you alluded to earlier has been dealt with, and we can come back and talk about it if you wish. But speaking of the public interest and who's supposed to get that information out there, in my case, I have a number of standing raw commissioners, the Intelligence Inspector General and more particularly the Integrity Inspector General, who have got very powerful capacities to have coercive hearings to look at any document, anything that me or my department are doing. And it's very important that people within our profession who have got concerns take those concerns to the statutorily appointed officers first and foremost. The notion that the journalist is the inspector general, or if you like, the conduit for the whistleblower, is actually contrary to our law.
Okay, I'm going to end with an interesting quote that you gave again to that ASPE discussion. We should above all draw on the strength of our traditions, values and history, which show us above all else that courage, cunning and organisation in the face of adversity will always prevail over the darkness, whether it takes the form of the tyrant, the invader, the terrorist, the saboteur or the criminal who thinks nothing of selling death to a child. It doesn't sound as if you feel we're facing a benign world. Again, I ask, do you want us to sort of move to a semi-war footing, or what is it that you want of us?
Well, it's not what I want of my fellow Australians. My job is to provide advice and then to enact the laws of the land and the directions of the executive government of the land. It's really about being thoughtful, as we are in our household activities, our personal finances, of taking the prosperity and the riches that we're blessed with and being prudent, as we are with our house. I mean, very few people lack locks on their houses. Very few people these days lack a fire alarm and a smoke alarm and or intruder alarms. It's really about just designing in prudently, sensibly, and in a way that's not designed to raise anxiety or to raise apprehension, sensible, targeted, proportionate security features, whether it's in the cyber realm, whether it's in how we interact online so that we're not duped or in any way taken advantage of. It's about how our supply chains work. All of those things, whether they are done for commercial reasons or for governmental reasons, should have security built in as just simply as unobtrusive as possible and with the least amount of fear-inducing, anxiety-inducing features. Now, yes, if God forbid we ever got into something that looked like a war, then Australia would have to move to a war footing. Yes, of course. A pandemic that is so impactful in terms of its global as well as regional and national consequences, of course, has to be dealt with as if it's not business as usual. And you're seeing, even today, state closures, you're seeing the need to control sale of items at supermarkets. It's about flexing and being agile in the face of events and activities that come your way, but in a way that's pre-thought, pre-planned to the extent that you can, consistent with point I made earlier that you can never predict the future precisely, to have the capacity and the capability to flexibly mobilise around those risks as they materialise. But in the end, we don't live in order to be secure. We live in order to pursue happiness. And being secure is a key enabler of that, but it's just an enabler and nothing more, Geraldine.
All right, Mike Pozzillo, it's terrific to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you so much. I've enjoyed our discussion. Thanks, Geraldine.
And that's Mike Pozzillo, Secretary of the Department of Home Affairs and a long-time Canberra bureaucrat.